You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 30th of January 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
These sorts of analysis have been proved to be wrong in the wake of the referendum, not least because there is huge uncertainty around any forecast, especially in the long run, and especially in the context of a major strategic choice.
Brexit Minister Steve Baker in the role of the man who jumps off a cliff and says this is going fine so far on the way down. Should the government release its impact studies now they've been leaked? My guests Robin Lustig and Linda Yu will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the build-up to Donald Trump's first State of the Union address, the semi-demise of a controversial baseball logo, and Ferry McFerry face gate. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are the journalist and broadcaster Robin Lustig, former presenter of The World Tonight on Radio 4, and Linda Yu, economist and author of The Great Economists, How Their Ideas Can Help Us Today. Welcome both. And let's start with Brexit and the ongoing absorption of the idea that if one saws off one's own left hand, one will subsequently experience difficulty juggling. A leaked government report into three potential Brexit outcomes reports that each is bad for the United Kingdom's economy. While not news to anybody who understands anything, the revelations have rattled the British government. Brexit Minister Steve Baker has declared that the document is preliminary and requires further work, with the punctilious insistence on making sober decisions in receipt of all the facts which has characterised the Brexit movement from the off. Linda, you are actually an economist and therefore may actually understand any of this. Are you surprised by the news that Brexit is likely to be bad for Britain's economy?
No, I think even though forecasts are very difficult, we all know that economic forecasts don't have great track record. It's still the case that if you look across countries, for instance, you can see that trade, different forms of trade, are beneficial for an economy. So essentially, this impact assessment is saying that if Britain leaves the current trading arrangement with the EU, with tariff-free trade, very open markets, you get scale for your companies, and each of the alternatives that are currently being discussed would give you less access. So, for instance, the biggest impact would be if the UK began to trade with the EU on WTO terms. The impact assessment says that's going to mean that growth would be 8%. Less in the next 15 years. And so that's really where that comes from.
Robin, we'll come back to the economics of it shortly, but just as a journalistic enterprise, these reports were leaked to and published by BuzzFeed. How big a scoop is this?
Oh, it's good. I mean, it's something that the government didn't want to see the light of day. They put in place, it seems, the most extraordinary precautions to try to prevent it being leaked. The ministers who were given the presentations at which these findings were disclosed to them weren't actually given a copy of the document. They sat down and were given a verbal presentation. Somebody, though, got hold of a document and somebody then leaked it to BuzzFeed. It's a good scoop.
Linda, just going back then to the economics of it, you said that forecasts are difficult and not necessarily the kind of thing that you would wish to bet large sums of money on. This is a point that the Brexiteer camp has been trying to make today. That being the case, what is the point in assembling a report like this?
It's important for governments to look at what the different possible scenarios will be. And the reason for that is that if, for instance, you think there will be customs imposed on traded goods, if the UK were to leave the EU with no deal, that would be the WTO scenario. The government needs to make, for instance, provision for more customs officers at the border, better IT facilities to deal with what that means. So the reason they do that is because it prepares them for outcomes. I think it would be one argument is that even though, so let's take the budget for example, right? So nobody thinks that economic forecasts are that accurate, but if you didn't have them, how would the government plan for its budget every year? So that's what you would use. You should use it for that purpose and realize it's imperfect, but it's better than having no analysis of what a possible scenario for the UK economy will be in the future, because then you would just be winging it.
Can I just throw in my favourite saying about economic forecasting,
please,
which I used to have pinned up on the wall of my office at the BBC? It's ascribed to J.K. Galbraith, I think, and it goes like this. The sole purpose of economic forecasting is to make astrology look respectable.
it is J.K. Galbraith.
Robin, does any of this strike you as a game changer? I mean, because we've seen the dynamic in the response to these leaks already, in that pro-Remain people have said, there you go, this proves we were right all along, whereas Brexiteers just say, well, the experts are always wrong about absolutely everything, this doesn't make any difference.
I think that's exactly the right question to ask, and I think the answer is no, it's not a game changer, it doesn't change anybody's mind, because the arguments over Brexit, although on one level they are indeed about economic prospects, the reasons why people voted in the referendum go far beyond economics, and they're to do with their feelings about who they are and what they want their country to be, and all kinds of very difficult and vague concepts which nevertheless are very deeply felt. This isn't going to change anybody's mind, and it's actually not going to change the politics either. The politics are tricky. The economic forecasting, I don't think, will make any difference at all.
Lindy, are you sceptical at all of the Brexiteers' continued insistence that the Brexiteer argument was an entirely economic and rational one? Is that why you think people voted to leave the EU?
No, I agree with Robin. I think it's a very complicated set of issues. I think economics played a part in it, but I think it's probably less important than other issues around anti-status quo, around migration, around no one can tell us what to do, so sovereignty. I think it's a very, very complicated mix. And it's probably different for different segments of people as to why they felt that way, which is why these Brexit assessments probably won't make a big impact in terms of the debate. But I actually feel reassured that the government has these. And one can argue they probably should have had these before the referendum so that people can look at the impact assessment, criticize it if you like, but at least you would have some sense of what the current possibilities are as to what will look like in a few years' time.
Well, David, the significance of this, I think, Andrew, is that it is yet another indication of the disarray in which the government finds itself. The fact that these kinds of documents are being leaked to journalists means that there is an immense amount of disquiet going on within the government machine, and that tells us something about the way in which the government is really flailing about.
Just a final thought on the politics of this, Robin. As you've said, it's unlikely that this is going to change anybody's mind, but does it alter the momentum even slightly towards, say, the prospect of a vote on the final deal, by which I mean, I guess, a referendum on the final deal, even though the leader of the opposition, Jeremy Corbyn, has once again affirmed that as far as he's concerned, that's a non-starter?
Well, there are some signs that a growing number of British voters are beginning to think another referendum, once the terms of a possible deal are known, might be a good idea. And it's possible, I suppose, that forecasting of this kind might increase people's doubts, particularly that relatively small number of people who did vote to leave the EU and may now be having second thoughts. They may now be having third thoughts.
Well, let's now look ahead to tonight's State of the Union address, the first such speech by US President Donald Trump. Two things seem likely. One is that Trump will explain at wearisome length what an outstanding success his first year has been in absolutely every respect, entirely thanks to his own unique qualities. The other, and this is assuming that he gets through the thing without punching an usher or biting the head off a chicken, is that the American pundit class will afterwards queue up to acclaim his performance as presidential. Linda, what are you most looking forward to?
To seeing which Trump shows up. He's very unpredictable. He could be sticking to a script, in which case he will, I'm sure, outline his achievements and what he hopes to achieve and confirm that he is the most successful president ever after his first year. I think we all expect that. But will we get that? Or will we get somebody who speaks more off the cuff, as he is wont to do, which is to essentially start to go off on perhaps some of the subjects that he tends to focus on? So the Russia investigation. allegation, Crooked Hillary. It's quite hard to know which one you'll get on the night and in which proportion.
Robin, even by Donald Trump's standards, and this is said with all due deference for his extraordinary ability to always find a level beneath what you assumed was rock bottom, but even by his standards, going off script during the State of the Union would be quite something, wouldn't it?
It would be quite something. And to be honest, I don't expect him to do that. He has, over recent months, shown that when it matters, he can actually stick to a script. He did it in Davos last week. I think it's likely, although who can tell? I mean, he is the most unpredictable of unpredictable presidents. He will stick to the script. He will, as Linda says, trumpet his achievements. He will say it's been a greatest first year ever. He will, I suspect, have a pop or two at the lying media, as he loves to do. He will, I'm sure, say something about the fake news, about Russia collusion and all his favourite subjects. He is happiest when he's talking about his favourite topics. I don't think like to delve too far from the familiar. Will he say something about North Korea? He might do. He will, I suspect, say that he has prevented North Korea from waging war on the United States or something along those lines. But I think it's going to be a bit of an anticlimax.
Linda, a definite sort of point in the Donald Trump State of the Union drinking game will be him taking credit for the performance of the stock market, the relative health of the US economy, and so forth. Is he entitled to any credit for that? I mean, and I'm semi-sympathetic on this, given that if the economy had completely tanked in the last 12 months, people would sure as heck be blaming him. But is the current, I guess, mini boom that America appears to be experiencing actually anything to do with anything he's done, or would he be the rooster taking credit for the dawn?
I think partly is due to him, and it has to do with the tax cuts, the tax reform bill that's, I think, surprised a lot of Democrats. But it wouldn't be solely due to him, because that's a bill that was crafted by the Republicans, who control both houses of Congress, are in a position to do something they've clearly been wanting to do for some time. And when you have this kind of massive tax cut, especially for corporations and the wealthy, it tends to boost confidence. And that's one of the reasons why the economy has been recovering, and that's what he inherited. That's the part he can't really claim credit for. But because interest rates have been going up and it hasn't dented the stock market, that's because businesses are very bullish, for lack of a better word, about having to pay less tax in the future. And that's what's essentially boosted asset markets in particular. So I think he can claim some credit, but I wouldn't say that he should claim all the credit. And there's another saying that one of his former aides said is a misperception about Trump, and I think it might be relevant in this context, is that he says that he didn't say this about economics in general, but just Trump in general. He said, most people think that Trump doesn't know what he doesn't know, but Trump knows what he doesn't know and doesn't think he needs to know it. And so I think sometimes on economics, it's a little bit apropos.
Robin, I did want to ask you about what I'm clearly anticipating is going to be the response of the American media class. And we've seen this a few times over the last year, that when Trump has managed to get through some public event without doing anything especially disgraceful, people have all of a sudden gone into full, at last, Donald Trump became president tonight, etc. And assuming this goes down the way that you think it probably will, that he'll just read what's on the auto cue and generally behave himself, I think we can probably expect a fair bit of that. Why is that? Is it a, and this is a pet theory I've invented within the last hour, but is that a difference between the British media classes and, in fact, possibly the British and their American equivalents, that whereas the British are accustomed to sneering at their political masters, Americans still want to think the best of their president and the office they occupy, don't they?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, the big difference, of course, is that our politicians are separate from our head of state. Our head of state is the Queen, and she is an entirely different category. The President of the United States is both the head of state and the head of government, and therefore he both embodies the identity of the state, the majesty of the office, but he's also a politician with cloven hooves, like all politicians have. And I think that is a big difference. I think there are a lot of Americans who would love to think that the person who occupies the Oval Office is worthy of the office that they hold and the office in which they sit. A lot of people doubt that Mr. Trump is such a person. Yes, a lot of journalists would love to think that somehow or other, over the next few hours, Donald Trump will turn into some entirely new form of human being and will suddenly become worthy of that title, President of the United States of America. I have me doots.
Linda, he is, to put it charitably, a divisive character. There's some Democratic Congress folk have said that they're not going to go. They're going to boycott the speech. Is there something to be said for that? And perhaps could it even be taken further? Is there an excuse on this occasion for a bit of, good old-fashioned booing?
Oh, dear, he would not like that. I think Donald Trump is, yes, I think he is. He's controversial. I think he's made it hard to think about the word presidential in the same way. I think he's clearly changed he's a different character in office, but he's still POTUS. He's still president of the United States. And I think Democratic lawmakers, should they choose not to go, that is up to them. But I think listening to the head of the executive branch, who is the head of state in the U.S., I think is something that they should probably do and try to work with him. Those who have worked with Trump, I think, come away with different impressions of him, depending on what it is that they were working with him on. But I think a number of them do say that he is not ideological. And of the different people in the White House you could work with, you can work with Trump on some things. And maybe we saw that with the aversion of the government shutdown until February the 8th. So I think while he's in office, I think trying to work with the president is the right thing to do.
Well, on that conciliatory note, we will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Robin Lustig and Linda Yu. Coming up next, the abdication of Chief Wahoo.
The First Monocle of 2018 is a media special, which takes us into the parallel worlds of music, movies, TV, technology, and, of course, print. We sit down with Takeshi Idezawa, the CEO of Japanese messaging app LINE, and get to know the cast of oddball characters who have helped him and his company conquer Asia. We head to LA for an expo that goes behind the scenes at the studios producing that most enduring and best-loved format in American television, the game show. From The Price is Right to Wheel of Fortune, we discover what lies behind the undying popularity of such programs. Then it's off to Indonesia to meet the team that publishes Compass, the leading Catholic-owned newspaper in a country where over 85% of the population is Muslim. And finally, in the design section, we take a tour around the former Berlin Broadcasting House that's been converted into a slick new arts hub. The Monocle February issue is out now. Get your media fix and pick up your copy today, or subscribe at monocle.com.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Robin Lustig and Lindy Yu. Now, the long-running campaign against the use of Native American iconography in American sport has scored a significant victory. As of the season after next, Major League Baseball team the Cleveland Indians will dispense with their logo, a grinning cartoon of a red-skinned warrior sporting a feathered headband, known as Chief Wahoo, who has adorned the Indians' uniform since 1947. Perhaps less nobly, merchandise featuring the image will remain available. Robin, first of all, are we sorry to see the back of Wahoo?
No, well, I'm not sorry to see the back of Chief Wahoo. I don't follow American sport as closely as I should, so I wasn't actually aware of his existence until quite a short time ago. But I'm staggered that he's still around, to be honest. I thought we had moved beyond such sort of cartoon stereotypes of particular racial groups quite a long time ago. I think it's time for him to go. I'm a bit puzzled by this idea that he still keeps selling the image on merchandise. I mean, if it's viewed as an image which is no longer appropriate, then surely it's not appropriate in any format.
It is weird. I think this is one of those things where there's always an argument because there are no hard and fast rules. I mean, Linda, I guess the question is, are all such appropriations inevitably inappropriate? Because there are many others in American sports. There's the Atlanta Braves, the Kansas City Chiefs, the Chicago Blackhawks, and obviously and perpetually controversially, the Washington Redskins.
I think it's only a matter of time before those teams are also going to have to rethink their logo. So this Cleveland Indian story around Chief Wahoo, if there's the question that I would have is, should they still be called the Cleveland Indians? Because for some time, Native Americans prefer to be called Native Americans, in which case this team, as well as the others that you mentioned, which essentially use casual terms referencing Native Americans and featuring them in ways which are caricatures, I think it does require some rethinking as to whether or not they should continue. They should probably do it before the movement catches them, as it were.
Well, I mean, the Washington Redskins one strikes me as an open and shut case on the basis that if I was to use that word to address a Native American, they would take extreme offence, and I think quite reasonably so. So I'm not really sure what the argument for it is. But, Robin, it is always a case-by-case thing. I remember talking to a Native American activist some years ago who was campaigning on this issue, and I asked him what he thought about the American military's appropriation of the same iconography, you know, Tomahawk missiles, you know, Chinook and Kiowa and Apache helicopters and so forth. And he sighed and said that he personally, I think he was a Cheyenne, if memory serves, says he wasn't keen. But he said the trouble we run up against is that the Apaches think it's really cool. So the question is, can it ever be a sincere homage?
No, I don't think so. These are tricky things, and I think they have to be approached with a certain amount of sensitivity. Language changes over time. People's sense of what is right and wrong also changes up to a point over time. I think it has to be done slowly, gradually, in consultation with everybody who's involved. I can well understand sports fans feeling that they don't want to change the name of their cherished team overnight. It's served them well for decades. I understand the arguments on both sides, but I agree with Linda. I think over time, all of these things will have to be rethought and probably changed.
Linda, is it excusable if there's been a measure of consultation? Florida State University football team are the Florida State Seminoles, but they have sought and more or less won over, I think, the approval of the actual Florida Seminoles.
That helps, but I think to an extent, yes, it's a case-by-case basis, but I think the question they're probably going to face is, does that still perpetuate? Is there anything in the images that are associated with the team that might cause offense to other Native Americans not based in the state of Florida? So I think those are the kinds of reasons why, yes, I completely agree with Robin. I think you need consultation, you need sensitivity around making changes. But I do think that in the 21st century, I think there has to be much greater accommodation of especially minority groups of any sort, of how they may feel being portrayed in a certain way. And I think we do need to think harder about this.
Well, one of the distasteful things I think about some of these team names is that they do suggest a sort of appropriation of an identity by people who aren't entitled to that identity. By calling yourselves the Washington Redskins, for example, there is a sort of implication that your identity is other than what it is. And I think that is no longer appropriate. It might have been acceptable 50, 60, 70 years ago. It's not acceptable now.
But with all due recognition that obviously the relationship between the United States and Native Americans is a special case for all sorts of obvious historical reasons, where do you stop with that? Do you tell the Minnesota Vikings that they need to rethink themselves? The Notre Dame Fighting Irish?
If there were a significant Viking community which objected to the idea that a team is called the Vikings, then yes, you would need to revisit that and have a look at it. One has to keep these things in perspective. There are an awful lot of problems in the world that need addressing. This probably isn't in the top three. Nevertheless, it is an issue. I think it's right that it should be addressed. And if there are wrongs, then they should be put right.
Well, if you think that is not a wrong that makes the top three of what's wrong with the world right now, we move along finally to what may be the stupidest scandal in political history. Late last year, to the vexation of all non-simpletons, it was announced that a new Sydney Harbour ferry would take to the water burdened by the name Ferry McFerryface, the name allegedly chosen, like similar others before it, by insufferable chortlers hijacking an online poll. It has now emerged that the name was not, in fact, on the final shortlist. It appears instead to have been the choice of the New South Wales Minister for Transport, Andrew Constance. Now, this particular item in the programme is, funnily enough, much like the name of this ferry, something of what we call in the old country a captain's pick. It annoyed me. I am from Sydney, more or less, and I was in Sydney last month and I saw Ferry McFerryface Pootling towards Circular Quay. I was actually hoping it was the ferry I was due to get on so I could make a point of refusing to board it and then telling my friends why I'd been late. I was quite looking forward to that. But the question is, Linda, this minister, Andrew Constance, who appears to have fixed the poll to call the ferry Ferry McFerryface, should he be merely sacked or actually arrested? Or am I overreacting? Overreacting slightly.
I suspect his position is no longer tenable, Andrew. I mean, this gross violation. No, I think...
Chance of lock him up, echoing through Sydney.
Well, I think one has to question whether whether somebody who should be in charge of this and any other public matter doesn't get that freedom of information request these days, bring lots of things to light, such as you distorting this very important poll to find the name of a ferry.
Well, Robin, we do actually have the British to blame for this, in that you may recall this goes back to a poll, I think it was late last year, or early last year, rather, at which there was a poll to name a magnificent and expensive Antarctic research vessel. Some wag put the name Boaty McBoatface on the poll, and the general public, being the general public, voted for it. Where does this come from, this insufferable tendency towards whimsy?
I have no idea. But let me turn the tables on you, Andrew. I mean, why does a ferry need to have a name at all? Do people actually say, I'm going to go and catch Ferry McFerryface?
It's a ship. You name ships. Ships have names. It's the way of things.
All right, well, here's the other question then. Of all the things that politicians lie about, why in God's name do they choose to lie about the name of a ferry?
It is.
Do Australians care what their ferries are called?
Well, I cared, and people did. I mean, there is a tradition that ferries are named. Actually, there's not a tradition of them being named after people. The Inner Harbour ferries, of which this is one, were named for a long time. They were named many years ago after the wives of governors and various other dignitaries, so they were all Lady something. Then they were renamed after the ships of the first convict fleet, and this new batch are being named after notable Australians. Ferry McFerryface will now be named May Gibbs in honour of the children's author. Linda, do you have a sort of fixed view about whether public transportation vessels should be named? This is true, actually. We don't name buses, do we?
We do name trains. We used to name steam engines.
We name trains and aeroplanes and ferries, but why not buses? Is that perhaps the bigger issue?
I think there's a tradition, as you say, there's a tradition of boats being named. Now that I think about it, Boaty McBoatface had its own controversy because that was the name picked by the public and it was overturned.
And quite rightly. The ship was named the Sir David Attenborough. But Boaty McBoatface was bestowed upon the launch from the ship, I think, or its attached submarine or something.
That just feels like a gesture. No.
Okay, here's the takeaway from this story, though, Andrew. Australian politics must be in a particularly sweet spot where this is the big controversy of the day. The name of a Sydney ferry, if that is the major issue in Australian politics, well, I think I want to move to Australia.
I couldn't possibly agree more. I think what we've all learned is that you should just never ask the public what they think about anything. I'm glad we're all agreed on that. That brings us to the end of today's show. Robin Lustig and Linda Yu, thank you very much for joining us. The show was produced by Bill Luty, researched by Gaia Lutz and Stephanie Sikia. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. More music next at 1900. It's Section D with Josh Fennett. There's more on the day's big stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London. I'll be your host for that as well. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.